Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Yes, it's Thursday and we're back. How are you? Everything okay? No? A bit rocky? You veered off-road a bit? Well, you know, it's January and these things happen. Just pick yourself back up and don't give yourself too much of a hard time. And just remember, February is right around the corner. And that can only be a good thing, right? Well, it's very cold. I was freezing yesterday. I thought it was Baltic. I thought it was going to snow. Enough. You're not here for a weather report from me, are you? You're here for season 9, episode 10. Just keep saying it. We'll get used to it eventually. And we're halfway through season 9. And we are wrapping up, for now, our food trilogy with another chef. Now, if you support us on Patreon, you might have known we've been doing these little, they're a bit like Instagram stories, for our lovely people who support us on Patreon. And you may have seen a Lens video the other day with myself and Griff. And we were in Yorkshire and we were in an industrial estate. It wasn't glamorous, but we were there to talk to Chef Allard Williams. I first discovered Allard when he was representing Wales on the Great British Menu, which for those outside the UK is one of the many, many food shows. And it's really exciting. You discover new talent, new chefs, new dishes. It's a joy. I love that program. And I've kind of been a big fan of Allard. And then last year, or was it the year before? Jeez, I don't know. I've missed a year. I read a review I don't want to call it a restaurant because it kind of is and it isn't. It's more like a test kitchen, I suppose. And it only serves like 10 people. It's very small, a little bit like what last week's guest, Eddie Shepherd, cooks for a small amount of people, except this obviously wasn't in his home. It's in a business park in Yorkshire. And it was an amazing review, I thought. And then I read who was heading it up, and it was Allard Williams. So I went along and had some of the most incredible food I've had. It was a special occasion. And it was an absolute feast. And anyway, we got talking. He was a big fan of the podcast. And I said, well, we should sit down and have a chat. So eventually we did it. And this is all about ambition and time and plans and striving. You know, Allard is determined. He's almost like a sportsman. He's like an athlete. And we talk about the grueling hours, you know, what it takes to be a chef. I mean, my God, it's hard work. But he's taking his foot off the gas now, which you'll hear. And we'll get to that in a second. What else have I got to tell you? Now, somebody hit me up on social media the other day with regards to Vicky's new show, Trigger Point, which is on ITV. It's on the ITV Hub. Get watching. Asking me why I wasn't doing a Trigger Point sort of recap podcast for ITV. And the simple answer is, I haven't been asked. ITV didn't ask me. Now, had they have asked me, I don't know whether I would have been able to do it, just because it takes a lot of time and a lot of prep. And yeah, it's just too much. But if you want a Trigger Point podcast, let me point you in the direction of the lovely guys at the Shrine of Duty podcast. They did a recap on all of Line of Duty. They did Vigil because Martin was in it. Now they're doing Trigger Point, Vicky's show. So head on over there if you want a Trigger Point recap podcast, because it's dead good and they're great. Another podcast recommendation. Now, we all need a laugh. We do. We really do. Now more than ever. If you know Peter Bainham, then you'll know that he's been behind some of the greatest comedy shows and films in the last 20 years. And if you're a fan of Chris Morris, The Day to Day, Jam, Blue Jam, which it was on the radio, I think, did it come to TV and it was Jam? Anyway, if you like that style of humour, it's kind of dark, it's twisted, it's a bit silly, it's funny. There is a podcast that Peter Bainham does, and it's called Brain Cigar. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's very, very funny, very surreal. Get your ears around Brain Cigar. But before you do that, let's head over to Yorkshire and have a chat with Chef Alan Williams for Season 9, Episode 10. And I start off by asking him something that, you know, we all need to know the answer to this. What's the best way to roast a chicken? Enjoy, and I shall see you at the end.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
That's me just sipping my tea there, Alan, because it's a cold day and we're in Yorkshire. Now, inevitably, of a weekend, there's two things in it that I have to fit in of a weekend when it's crazy. And one is getting the papers, which inevitably inspires me to go into the kitchen, because there's always recipes in there and everybody's always got these new hot takes, especially about a Sunday roast dinner. And I'm always on the lookout. It's a bit like the Holy Grail, the elusive roast chicken. Everybody always has their idea of what their best roast chicken is. And the only reason that people are listening today is they want to know your roast chicken. Give me your hot take of roast chicken, Alan, because I need a professional's opinion so I can lay this to rest.
Obviously, it's buying, you know, the best chicken you can get your hands on as well. You know, yeah. You don't have to go crazy, but I think it's getting a well-treated, well-looked-after chicken that you can source from your butchers, because at the end of the day, you know, you can only get a really good chicken from a good chicken. So classically, if I'm in a restaurant, you might brine it. So what I mean by that is for every litre of water, you got 100 grams of salt, so a cold brine. With some flavours, get some thyme, some rosemary, garlic, bay leaf, all that sort of thing, and actually submerge your whole chicken into it for an hour. All that's going to do is hold in the flavour and keep it moist inside then. But what you want to do then is obviously dry it really well. So do that like the day before, then pull it out and put it into your fridge. then let it almost dry out in your fridge and let the skin go back to be crispy. And then just like everybody's really, really scared of overcooking chicken. Like my mum back in the day would know it was ready, but let's give it another 10 minutes just in case. I don't want to kill anybody sort of thing. So I think everybody's afraid of chicken.
Mm.
So it's buying a probe is the most simple thing you can possibly do.
What, like a meat thermometer?
Meat thermometer.
Which I got this Christmas. Brilliant. Oh my God, it was incredible.
It's a game changer, it really is. So I've given my mum a series of different temperatures. That is, you know, it's really nice and safe to cook to. And like literally stick your probe into the thickest part. If it's a 62 degrees Celsius on your chicken, pull it out. It's perfect. Let it rest for like 10, 15 minutes, however long you can wait while you're looking at it salivating.
Yeah.
Just let it relax and then carve it. We cook a roast chicken in my house at least two times a week, if not more, because it probably is my death row meal. Like, absolutely. So it's so simple. And a lot of people are like, oh my God, you know, you've worked in Michelin-starred kitchens around the world. You should be eating foie gras and all this sort of thing. But yeah, I might put a little bit of cheeky truffle on top just because I could if it was my death row. But at the end of the day, a roast chicken dinner, we pretty much have most Sundays in my family because it's my daughter's favourite,
yeah.
It's my wife's favourite.
It's such a kid's favourite, though, isn't it? They love it.
And, you know, at the end of the day, when it's done properly, whatever properly is it's blooming delicious, so why not?
Next time, Michael, the one thing I've never done is done the brine the day before. What I did at Christmas... People will be telling off now. It's fine. Don't worry about it. I stuffed a load of butter underneath the skin and massaged it down with some tarragon. And it was very juicy, I must admit. It was very nice.
Well, fat is flavour. Unfortunately, in the world we live in, and we're getting told to eat less salt and less fat and everything. Well, at the end of the day, there's no getting away from it. It's fat is flavour. And if you can do that and you know, we're here for a good time, just put a little bit of butter underneath the skin and it will make the difference.
Now, you did touch on that about working in Michelin-starred kitchens. But obviously, what I want to do with you, I need to go back, way back. So who was inspiring you when you were growing up?
So growing up, I think it was all the Ramsay, Gordon Ramsay and Marco Pierre White were kings.
The quite rock and roll chefs of their time, weren't
they? Absolutely. They're the sort of people that would make any young chef want to put a set of chef whites on. And for me, looking back, they were my absolute heroes. So it sort of started where I didn't really, I was quite lost in school, didn't really know what I wanted to do. So
where were we? Let's just go back to geographically where we are.
Yeah, so Anglesey, North Wales. That's where I'm originally from. Mm. So the island of Anglesey. So it's, you know, going back to there, started in school and sort of didn't really know what I wanted to do. Got to sort of 15 and then basically started working as a pot wash, like most of the stories you'll hear in the industry. Started as pot washing.
Start at the bottom.
In a local bistro just across the bridge in Bangor. And it got to the point where chef had walked out, and then I was doing less hours in the pot washing. Like, oh, you get over here and do this salad and start with the absolute basics and then sort of get thrown in the pastry section and stuff. And sort of started thinking, oh, this is all right, this. And, you know, basically my 100% hours on the weekend became cooking rather than actual pot washing.
Yeah.
And it came to finishing school and actually trying to decide what I wanted to do in my life. And I thought, okay, let's pursue this. And went to catering college in Bangor. And it was sort of a game changer for me. I literally saw something that I really sort of wanted to do and really, you know, wanted to get good at. So did... You know, the first 12 months in level one catering, won student of the year. So I thought, okay, this is a good start.
Oh, we're on to a winner, eh?
Yeah, so second year, won student of the year again, which was in 2000. So that was student of the millennium, get me. So, you know, that was the real insight of, I might want to pursue this. So when I was working in college, I wanted to get a job in the best restaurant around, and that was a restaurant called the Bull's Head in Beaumaris on Anglesey. And the chef there, Keith Rothwell, was really famous for doing everything fresh, so doing everything properly. So we were buying fish straight in from the Menai Straits, you know, local meat, farmers growing our vegetables for us and everything. So again, it was as a fundamental basic to learn as a young chef, it was perfect.
And other places weren't doing that?
Not as much as Keith. Keith was just absolutely renowned. He was one of the sort of the first people in North Wales to really push fresh food and to do things, you know, like a lot of people are doing now, but we're talking in 98. Yeah.
Right.
In a previous life, long time ago. Yeah. But it was just, he was a pioneer in doing that for local people.
Because I was thinking about, sourcing local products in and around the area, because, the Great British Menu has been going on for so many years now. But prior to that, and they focus on certain farms and dairy farms and where they go and get their fish, and it's all these, they've sourced them locally to where they are. But I can't remember before that people doing that.
No, well, actually, now you talk about the year I did Great British Menu the first time in 2010, that was the actual theme of the actual programme, was local produce.
Right.
And that's why I excelled, because it's something sort of been drilled into me from a young age,
From working there with Keith.
Right. And then even more so the next position, when I worked at a restaurant called Place Bodegrois with Chris Chown, who was essentially the first Michelin-starred chef Wales ever had. Massive, massive hero, and basically a good father figure of mine. He took it to even the next level. So when I was working for Chris Chown, he was really pushed the importance of keeping it local and air miles and all that sort of sustainability and stuff. So when I was asked to represent Wales for Great British Menu and knew that the theme was actually local produce, what they were doing is giving you percentages out of 100%. Basically, on how much produce you're getting locally in your country or your area, and I was smashing late 90s for every dish because I had brilliant suppliers already there, so I didn't need to go and find essentially new suppliers and you make it all up and pretend you're doing this for telly. It was literally,
you knew exactly who to go to because you already had a relationship with them.
It was the people, and relationship is the biggest key for a chef. Is actually believing in your producers and your suppliers. Because essentially, it's very hard to get mediocre food and make it amazing. You're buying really, really good produce and ingredients from local people and people you trust with a face, and you can pick up the phone if there ever is an issue. For me, that's super important.
And it gets sorted if there is a problem.
Yeah, of course. And it's the world we live in. There always will be a few hiccups everywhere. Especially with fishmongers, where the weather dependent, who's going to go out picking hand dived scallops in Scotland when it's a tsunami? You're not, are you?
No, of course.
You've just got to take everything day by day.
So when you went into that second restaurant,
Place Bodegrois. So his name's Chris Chown.
That already sounds like I'm sweating because there's pressure already. Because if he was the first Michelin star winner in Wales, the pressure is going to be on. So what level were you going in?
Went as a commis chef right down the bottom.
Right.
So it was a really small, it was only four in the brigade. Usually when you're looking at Michelin starred restaurants and stuff, you're looking at massive brigades. But it was only four, so it was Chris.
Is that what they call a group of chefs?
Yeah,
a brigade.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
A brigade
of chefs.
Every day's a school day.
Brilliant.
So I was right down the bottom. I was number four of four, essentially. Right. And it was doing all the mediocre little small jobs. But I remember that, the first time of having that pressure where the senior sous chef was London through and through. So it was my first sort of little taste of working with a proper Cockney, a well-driven, well-greased chef. And I remember, simply peeling potatoes for Sunday lunch. He used to put a timer on me. He put a timer next to the bucket and go, Ryan, you've got this X amount of time, that bucket of potatoes, go. And it was almost, you're battling against the timer all the time. So that as a mentality is amazing. So you're not just going, do-do-do-do-do, peeling potatoes. You've got 2 hours to do whatever. It's like, you've got 12 minutes, go.
Well, because it is all about timing, isn't it?
And then one week you do it in 12 minutes, next week you do it in 11 and a half, next week you do it in 11.
Right.
So again, it's that, almost addictive.
You're just beating your personal best every week.
That's what chefing's about, is getting better every day. And down to a simple menial task like peeling a potato, you've got to be better the next week and the following week. So working at that level was amazing because it was it's the holy grail for the cooking industry. The Michelin Guide, the Red Book is what I believe that everybody gets out of bed for, is essentially try and get into that book and, try and essentially almost prove yourself to be at the level that all your peers are and, the industry heroes. So to actually get my first position, I remember when I went to for my interview with Chris and sort of going fresh out of college, and I'd won Student of the Year, I'd won Student Millennium, I'd done all this sort of different paperwork in college, and I went for my interview and Chris was just like, I don't really know what any of that is, like, can you cook? And I was just like, yes, chef, I believe so. He's like, right, you've got a job then, because he just didn't care that I'd won Student of the Year and this, that and the other. He was just like, literally, how good are you at your job? Not on paper, can you get in the kitchen and get your head down? And a lot of the time it's about, the personality rather than what you have on your CV. It's like, you know, what are you bringing to the kitchen? And to get an opportunity to go and work. And it was essentially the first time I'd moved away from home, so it was about an hour away from home.
And how old were you at this point?
I was 19.
Right.
So living down there, literally taken away from living with my mum and living down there. And it was a... We used to do six-day weeks. So we used to do Tuesday till Sunday. So we'd finish at maybe 4:30 on a Sunday and then be back again Tuesday morning. So we'd get Sunday evening and Monday off. But it was...
But these are long hours, aren't they?
Yeah, long hours. You know, average kitchens, you're talking 16, 18-hour days.
It's a bit longer than a filming day, Aled.
Yeah, I know. It's a tough day, but that's just the norm. It's just what you do, and sort of there's no way around it. And you know, it's getting a lot better these days. I think a lot of people are focusing on four-day weeks or four-and-a-half-day weeks and this, that, and the other. But essentially, you can still cram a lot of hours into a four-and-a-half-day week.
So when you go to an interview, say... for that instance, and he said, right, I don't care about these accolades because they don't really mean anything. Yeah. Bottom line is, can you cook? You said, yeah. Did you have to then get in the kitchen and rustle him something up? Or?
Not on that one. I have in previous positions, or more senior positions, I've had to sort of put things on a plate. But because you're going in on a commis chef, you're not really expected to be able to really come up with new dishes yourself, because you're a young talent which is getting moulded into the future, essentially.
And it's about following orders.
Yeah, right. So, you know, obviously I've been senior positions in many places since, and whenever you're looking at people, you might get, you know, 10 or 20 people that come in for the position. It's not always, you know, the person with the best CV that gets the job. It's actually, do you care? You know, do you want to be there? Have you got the right mentality to actually bring something to the brigade? Are you there just because your parents have told you to be there,
right,
or have you come there for the right reasons? So,
and also, I suppose, do that person who's hiring think that your personality is going to fit with however many is in this brigade? I'm going to keep using brigade now.
Yeah, but that's exactly it. And with this really small kitchen, like four chefs, you have to get on with each other. You spend more time with your team than you do your loved ones. So if you all hate each other, that's a tough day, surely.
And also, if you've got a chip on your shoulder, I mean, it's going to get knocked out. You're pretty sharp.
Absolutely.
Especially, I think, in a professional kitchen.
100%. And the restaurant is down the arm of Wales, down the Llyn Peninsula. So it's in the back of beyond. So, you know, you're all sort of potentially in your any time off you probably spend together as well, because you're all just, you know, a tight-knit community. Where Chris Chown had been there for many, many moons and sort of really, really took me to the next level. Like, literally got that buzz into me about finding, you know, the right ingredients and sustainability. And he taught me a lot about business as well, where a lot of chefs, you know, might be able to put amazing food on a plate, but truly as a business sense, you know, Chris, it was his bread and butter. At the end of the day, if it wasn't succeeding, it was his account that was, you know, feeling it.
Yeah.
So he was brilliant in actually truly showing me the difference between running a restaurant and running a business, because we had, I think it was 8 or 10 rooms there as well. So we were classed as a restaurant with rooms because there wasn't an official sort of reception area. So, you know, it was that sort of wonderful grade 2 Georgian house in the middle of nowhere. And it was a beautiful, stunning, and it'll always be sort of regarded as Wales as one of the greatest restaurants ever. So it was amazing to go there. So I was there for a couple of years the first time, because I went back on a previous time as well. But what we used to do is we used to close off season. So we used to close like maybe the end of November and then reopen in February, because the trade was just non-existent. So there's no point doing 6 on a Tuesday night or 8 on a Wednesday night, because you've got the same brigade there, you've got to switch all the same gas on, you've got to do this, that and the other, and you're just going to kill yourself. So what Chris... sort of, he must have learned the hard way one time. So he decided we'd always shut for maybe like about 10 weeks. So a lot of the team used to go off and do different experiences in different other restaurants.
Is that what you did?
So I actually, it was in 2000 and I can't remember, whenever the Rugby World Cup was, where Johnny Wilkinson did the kick. So Chris Chown,
everybody knows I know nothing about sport. Alan, don't give me sporting references.
Well, that happened.
Right.
So when Chris went out to Australia, he came back and he said to me, he said, what do you fancy doing the off-season? I said, chef, I really fancy going to Australia. So this is, you know, I was 21. He said, oh, okay. I was like, I really fancy a little bit different experience out there. I sort of never said anything else about it.
Next. Is that because you didn't know what you were going to specialise in and you just wanted a sort of broader sort of range of spectrum of ideas?
Yeah, absolutely. I think chefs at a young age, I think it's really good to sort of learn from different peers and different chefs. I think it's very hard to know what your own style is until you've worked for other people.
Yeah.
And then you can actually pinpoint what actually close to your heart and what you believe in. So it's really good to sort of not hop, skip and jump. When you look at a CV and he's done 2 months there, 1 month there, 3 months there, you know that's danger. The chef's not going to stay with you.
And but, I suppose at such a young age, you're just trying to portray somebody else's style to the best of your ability.
Absolutely. You are literally
copying somebody else's food on a plate.
Yeah, copy and paste, and that's what's the really sort of really getting connected to the belief of the chef, whoever's food it is, and just getting drilled to cook it properly, to present it properly, because it all matters. So essentially, I thought, okay, let's dip my toes into Australia, because as a young guy, you always look at Australia thinking how beautiful it is.
Yeah.
So we came in the following day, and Chris used to cook breakfast, and you sort of used to let him cook breakfast. And after breakfast service, he came to me and said, "Aled, office now." And I was just like, "Oh my God, what have I done?" So straight into his office, and there was a small office with a desk and two chairs across from each other. So I obviously went to sit down at one of the chairs. He goes, "No, my chair." I was like, "Okay." So I sat in his chair. He's like, "Look at my laptop." So there was an email on it saying, "I'd be delighted to offer Aled Williams a chef de partie position at the Bathers Pavilion in North Shore, Sydney." And I was just like, "What?"
Oh my God.
And I was just like, "What's going on, chef?" He's like, "Oh, yeah, sent an email to the chef." When he went out there to follow England for the Rugby World Cup, he went to a series of different restaurants. And this was his personal favourite restaurant and sort of a restaurant that he believed would connect to what I'd been cooking for the years beforehand and what I'd learned. And he was just like, "You've worked amazing for me the last couple of years, and it's a bonus. I'm going to pay for your flight."
No way.
And I was just like, this is just, like tear jerking stuff. Like I said, he's helped me a lot in my life. And, to actually get that experience, I was just like, right, I have to commit to this now. It was just an idea beforehand. It was just like, I fancy Australia. Now I'm actually going. So the flight's booked in, I think it was January the 2nd or something. So you've got, and then you're moving to the other side of the world to crack on with it. So it was a, wow, okay.
But also, it says so much about him as a nurturing figure, but a lot of what he thought about you, because you just mentioned it, as you just said, but he's now pushing you to go further.
Yeah, you could see the spark, which is sort of a thing, like I said, for young chefs that really want to try and succeed and try and, make a little name for themselves.
It's almost like having that great teacher that, everybody talks about that one great teacher that inspired them.
It's a tough one because sometimes you want to hold on to what you've got, and there might be a young chef that you think is amazing and you're thinking, "I wish he'd stay with me forever." But then you can't hold people back as well. So it was a really good step for brave step almost, that Chris would actually want me to go to Australia because you're not going there for 5 minutes. So.
No, exactly.
Yeah, I went out there and it was phenomenal. So I worked in Bathers Pavilion. And then Helen, my now wife, she was in university at the time, so she came over, and then we travelled the whole North Shore on the East Coast. So we
and was there a time frame, or do you just go, "Well, let's go and see what happens"?
Yeah, we sort of booked a sort of a year visa, and then went out there. And then Helen was restricted with university, so she came out for, I think it was about a month. Based in Sydney, worked our way down to Melbourne, flew back up to Cairns, and then back down to Sydney. So it was a huge chunk of the country. And again, what you learn from actually travelling, I'm a massive believer of, I've learned a lot, not necessarily in the kitchen sometimes, but just travelling.
Yeah.
So we did that. So when we were coming to the end of Australia, I was looking back home again, thinking, right, and what's the up and coming? What are the great restaurants? And I saw there was a chef called Adam Simmons in a restaurant called Ynysheer, which is in Mid Wales. Ynysheer is where Gareth Ward is now, and he's just phenomenal. Absolutely, I have no idea how that chef hasn't got 2 Michelin stars for Wales, but he's a phenomenal chef. But when I was there in 2005, it was Adam Simmons who was Le Manoir through and through. Chef again, one of the most driven people I've ever worked with, and it was a small 12 cover restaurant, really small, 3 of us in the kitchen, but again we were doing mega hours there because he was so precise. The actual perfection he was trying to get on a plate was phenomenal, and it was some of the best accolades Wales has ever seen when he was there, and so driven. So I went to came back and did a work experience with Adam and got the job. which was phenomenal. So I was with him, stayed with Adam for 6 months before I then started looking across the border to England, because there was a job coming up at Midsummer House in Cambridge.
Right.
Two-star Michelin. Yeah. So again, it was that sort of almost what's the difference between the one-star to the two-star, and actually seeing what it took to get to the next level. So again, went for a job at Midsummer House and got that and started at Midsummer House.
And when you're going up to a two-star, is there much more pressure?
Yeah, of course.
Or is it just a different class?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the pressure is the same no matter what you are. I think a lot of kitchens set the pressure, and you obviously set the pressure yourself as well.
Yeah.
I think there is definitely a different quality. So there was 12 of us in the kitchen there. So there was 6 sections, 2 per section. I think as soon as you walk in, you know there's a different feel, different class of the pressure that you're under to actually emulate the chef's food. And it was amazing. The food there is some of the food that I've connected to the most, where Daniel Clifford's sort of almost really likes taste and textures. So if he'd put something on a plate, he'd put beef, a couple of different textures, carrots, 3 ways, 4 ways or something, and take something. It might only be 2 ingredients, but you might have 10 elements on your plate.
Sure.
And it's something that I have connected to. So I love that sort of taste and texture sort of feel to it.
Just going back to kitchens and just going back to Australia for a second, we've touched on the energy and the intensity of various kitchens here in Wales. Is there a different energy in Australia? Do they go about things differently there, or is the impact the same?
The impact's pretty close. There's no Michelin over there, so they've got chef hats in the restaurant I was working at. I was a 2-hat restaurant. Phenomenal. It was right on the coast, right on the beach, and you could literally see the seaside from the kitchen. It was phenomenal.
Wow.
But obviously you're in there sweating, because I was working on the hot starter section to start off with, and you had a salamander in my face, a hot grill in front of me, an oven down by my knees. It was like everything was just pumping heat toward my face. So at any point you had a break, you just dive into the sea and hope you're not going to get eaten by a shark, essentially. The head chef was Australian, but predominantly he would employ Europeans.
Right.
Because his words were, Australians are lazy. His words.
get that out there now.
So it was, the kitchen was mostly Europeans. There was quite a few Australians there as well. And funny enough, a lot of those Australians that I worked in Sydney with came over and started working in the Ledbury in London.
Right.
Because Brett Graham is Australian himself. So so a couple of the guys that I worked with, worked a long time with Brett Graham. So I've seen them since, and they've gone on to fantastic things. But I think the pressure was similar. The produce is very different, which is amazing, because there's no fish alike over there that there is in our seas.
Right.
So you could sort of almost look at something and go, that sort of looks like a trout, or that sort of looks like a halibut. Then you've sort of, your experience will tell you how to cook it, right or wrong. Obviously the chef will show you how they do it as well. But a lot of the Moreton Bay bug tails are similar to sort of almost like a crayfish or a lobster or something.
Right, so okay,
using my own British experience to look at their ingredients and know what to do. It was big hours like every place is, but what I've learned there was really good, because they've got a lot of Asian influence over there as well.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Which I adore. Mm. I really do love Asian influence in my cuisine as well.
Just going back to hours. Now, these are long hours. They're intense hours. Yeah. You're not going to have time for much of your personal life at this point. Now I'm thinking, because you're still with Helen, she's still your girlfriend at this point.
Yeah.
Has that had an impact on your personal life?
Oh, massively, because you, as the industry is renowned for sort of putting all your personal life in a box and forget about it and stick it under your bed and it might come back out one day. But it's, you've got to say no to weddings, to birthdays. It's your best mate's 20th birthday. So what? You can't get it off. You can't go to your chef and say, chef, especially at a restaurant like Place Bodegrise, and there's only 4 chefs there. We couldn't take any time off because there's nobody to cover.
Only 4 in your brigade, Aled. You can't take any time off.
100%. And that's genuinely what it was. So that when you took your 10 weeks off at the end of the year, that was your personal time to, you just hope that, something might happen, for your birthdays or anniversaries or Christmas in that time. Because in larger restaurants, you might be able to wiggle off a few days here and there, but almost you can't let the team down as well. It's that mental sort of, pain that, oh, can't let the brigade down as well, so I can't go to this, I can't go to that. So you say no to pretty much everything in your life. So to actually find, someone in your life that will go on this journey with you is difficult. And, you know, I've obviously found an absolute keeper, hence my wife now.
And what does Helen do for a living?
So she works in charity sector.
Right.
So she's got a couple of different jobs, but again, based at home for good family life, and it works perfectly for us now. So she's never been in the food industry, which I sort of like as well, because sometimes when you work in the same sector, you go home and you might have a bit of a whinge about what's happening in your world and stuff. Yeah, and
that's hard work, Alan. Trust me.
Yeah, I know. So I'm really happy that, you know, sort of she's never worked in the, so she'll listen to me to a point and go, all right, shut up, I'm bored of that.
And also it puts things into perspective, doesn't it, for you?
Yeah.
And we'll get on to later on about how you're in a position now where you can spend more time at home. But let's go back to this. We've had so many brilliant names of restaurants. Where are we now? We're in a 2 Michelin star
Midsummer House.
Midsummer House, that's right.
Yeah, so Midsummer House.
Were you there, chef de partie?
Chef de partie. So I was on the garnish section. Garnish section is pretty much considered one of the toughest sections in.
Explain to me what that is.
So the garnish, you're cooking everything that goes next to the meat, essentially, or the fish. All the vegetables and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So you've got a sauce section, which will make the sauces and probably cook the meat and the fish, depending on how big your brigade is. Sometimes you have to multitask on different sections. But I was running the garnish, and like I said, where Daniel's food was, you know, a beautiful piece of meat with maybe 8 or 9 different textures sat next to it. Well, obviously, I had to cook all those. So if you've got an a la carte menu where table of 6 will order 6 different main courses, you're talking potential 30, 36 different things to get ready at the same time. So where the saucier or the meat cook would have 1 duck, 1 cod, 1 halibut, blah, blah, blah. And that's tough, you know, to obviously cook all them to perfection, but to cook 30 odd different garnishes to go.
And also, you've all got to be in sync, because if his meat's ready and he's sauced it all up and you haven't got that garnish on,
literally
everything's going to go to pot.
It has to be for timing. So usually whoever's cooking the meat or the fish will break down the timing. So you look to him or her, they'll say, right, and 5 minutes to the pass and count down, 4, 3, 2, 1, and you've sort of all come up together. And then whoever's working the pass, it might be the head chef. So there'll be the yes, no man, whoever's going onto the plate. So if you bring in 30 of those elements up at the same time and 3 of them are below par, you're going to know about it, because at the end of the day, the meat will overcook, the fish will go cold, blah, blah, blah. So it's an expensive mistake. So
what happens if it goes to the pass? And I take it, is it the head chef that clears it before it goes?
Yeah.
And he's not happy with certain elements, does it just get slung out and then you have to go over again?
Absolutely. Exactly that. So.
Oh, my God. I mean, that must have happened at some point.
Yeah. No, you'd be sort of, that was one of the kitchens that you'd know about it in Central. There might be a pan flying left, right and centre. And at the end of the day, it's a business as well. So, you know, if you've got a table of 6 and you've got to start again, you know, some things, you know, meat might be able to hold, you might be able to get 30 seconds or a minute out of meat or something. But with fish, it literally is like a mountain. As soon as you hit the peak of the mountain where it's cooked to perfection, whatever that is, there's only one way it's going, and that's downhill.
Yeah.
It's getting cold, it's dry, it's just not so pleasant to eat. So it's really super important that everything comes up the same time, cooked well. And if not, if you're running behind or struggling, it takes a brave chef to put their hand up and say, chef, I need 2 more minutes. Because sometimes the meat cook can bring the pan, you know, a little bit to the left, so it's not so vigorous, it's not so hot, so it's slowing down that sear of the meat or the fish or whatever.
So not only is it about synchronicity, it's about communication.
Communication is so key in this industry, it really is. And, you know, obviously it takes a brave person to say, I'm not quite there, chef, please help, I need this. But the end of the day, and that's how brave you've got to be, and just say, Ryan, I need a minute, I need 2 minutes, because the food will be better for it. So yeah, you might get your head blown off for not being there,
but it'll be worth it at the end of the day.
Communicating before you actually get to the pass, making sure the quality is there before you actually put it on a plate, because it's it's one of those sort of sink or swim moments. There is making sure that everything is cooked correctly.
And I suppose just sticking your head above the parapet and saying, I need 2 minutes, I need 30 seconds, that will come with age and knowledge, I suppose, wouldn't it? Because you wouldn't be saying that when you're a 19-year-old.
No, not at all. And it's one of those, again, experience. Everybody says you can't buy experience, and it's super true. You know, at the end of the day, you can get young chefs that are really good cooks, but, you know, it takes good experience to understand that you're not quite on your timings. And timing is crucial for any kitchen. So it's a brave man, but it's the correct decision. And hopefully the meat and the fish won't sort of sacrifice for your ill timings, if you like.
Now, going back through when you started out, when you were peeling those potatoes, to where we are now, right, where we are in our story here talking, have you seen a change in the kitchens, in the brigades? Because I'm sure when you started out at 19, it was very male-heavy. Is the ratio getting better? Are we seeing more? Because, you know, I think of Angela Hartnett, or I think of someone like Claire Smythe, who were like incredible at what
Absolutely.
They do. But they've been working on it for 20-odd plus years.
Yeah.
Are we seeing more females come into the kitchen now? I suppose, was it accepted back then? I mean, it seems like the Marco Pierre White stuff, it seemed like such a lads' club, and quite a bully, from an outsider, quite bully boy sort of tactics.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm sure they wouldn't speak in the way that they do about women now, you know, otherwise they'd get a frying pan over their head.
You couldn't do whatsoever.
Yeah.
A lot of the kitchens, you know, I've worked in have been male dominant. There's no way around that. I think modern day kitchens have got a lot more females, which is brilliant because they bring that wonderful temperament, which, you know, sort of almost that mother-like, we're like, no, you can't do that, which is really good for modern day kitchens. My last executive chef was Lisa Goodwin-Allen in Northcote.
Her
food is just brilliant. The touch, the presentation, that almost feminine sort of touch of the presentation is something that I learned a lot from. Yeah, Lisa's brilliant, and she's an absolute machine where you look at Northcote. So I was against Lisa on Great British Menu when I was the Welsh champion. She was the champion of the Northwest, so sort of known her since 2010. And then in, I don't know, was it 8 years ago, she was going on maternity leave, so they wanted someone to go to Northcote as a senior position to sort of almost take her position while she went off. And I took that role. So I was the head chef in Northcote when Lisa went on maternity. And then when she came back, she was promoted to executive chef. So we worked together. So it was Nigel at the top, then Lisa, then myself, because it's a huge hotel. And there's like 30-odd in the kitchen, so it's a beast. So it needs that really good firm senior positions at the top. So, yeah, I worked with Lisa for a couple of years. The lady is an inspiration to all of us.
Absolutely.
You know, there was females in the kitchen in Northcote as well. But like I said, there's not as many as you might think.
Do you think not as many as there should be?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I suppose do you think the door is more open than it was years ago?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of people are really pushing to, especially with the Roof Scholarship and these wonderful competitions that are out there. You know, so there was a big drive a couple of years ago for the Roof Scholarship to try and get more females in there, and there was a really good run of getting some wonderful talent through to there, which is only going to be really good for the industry. But now it's you know, you'd hope that you'd never get discriminated like you would back in the day.
No, of course not.
Obviously, you can't speak for everybody. There's going to be idiots out there. But, you know, the kitchens, it's down to how good you are. It doesn't matter, you know, what you are. And you know, looking at the names you've named, Angela Hartnett, she seems to judge me everywhere I go. So she judged me on Great British Menu. She judged me when I won the Ramsay Scholarship. You know, she's been a judge of my food many places.
Yeah.
And, you know, she has the Welsh background as well. So the connection there. You know, Claire Smythe of Core. I mean, wow. Mm. You know, a lot of people say she's the greatest female chef. It doesn't matter if she's female. She is one of the greatest chefs on this planet.
Yeah.
Full stop. What that lady can do is a huge inspiration to all of us that wear white. She is an absolute phenomenal lady. So, you know, it doesn't matter that she's female. She is just amazing.
Now, we've spoken about the intensity of a service in a kitchen. When you bring television cameras in, because I want to talk about how we start the Great British Menu now, does that change things for you?
Yeah.
Because you've probably got how many cameras? You've got at least three cameras.
Absolutely.
Around.
Yeah.
And they're getting right into what you're doing. And there's a time limit as well. So it is like a service. And also, your food's being not judged just by punters. It's being judged by food professionals.
yeah, it was a completely different sort of world to what I was used to, you know, being a small cog in big machines in the industry where you're sort of working your way down from the bottom to as high as you can possibly get. But to get the phone call to, do I want to represent Wales on the Great British Menu, that's, you know, that was huge for me. Cause
did you have to think about it?
No. Instantly. So basically what they do is when I did it, they asked about five chefs to do sort of a screen, sort of camera day. So they'd come into the kitchen just to see if you could multitask and actually cook on camera and you weren't just a head down silent chef.
Oh, so there's a bit of a screen test before.
Yeah, screen test beforehand. Right. So they came to the kitchen beforehand and they spent the day with me to see that I could chat as well as cook at the same time. And I believe,
what restaurant were you at this point?
So I was back at Place Bedegroy. So I went... after going to a few different places, I went back to Place Bedegroy as head chef.
Right.
So again, it was full circle. I was only 26, which was, you know, the pressure of being a head chef of a Michelin star.
That's a lot of pressure so young, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but again, it was at that time in my life where I was really hungry for where I wanted to be.
Because it seems what I'm getting from where we've gone from the potatoes is like there's a real sort of sportsmanlike ambition here. Yeah. So there is end game, there is goals, isn't there?
Oh, 100%. And that's where I've sort of, again, it's been driven into me probably in the kitchens I've come through is the sort of the hunger to succeed because nothing else is acceptable to you know, you have to, you know, be your best every day you get out of bed. And to be invited back as head chef from Chris was an amazing full circle. So it was representing the restaurant, like I said, it's regarded as one of the all-time greatest restaurants in Wales.
Yeah.
So Chris was still there, chef patron, he was still doing service with me. But, you know, to be essentially his wingman and yes, no man to make sure the quality that we aspired to every day was still good enough and still, you know, getting better all the time and getting new suppliers and getting new produce was phenomenal.
So were you coming in there and you were bringing in new ideas and you were ticking things off at the pass, you were just stepping up to be a head chef?
So it was my first ever head chef job and it was amazing. I remember going there and we got into the kitchen like a week before we reopened Place Bedegroy. I was saying it was closed off season. I remember doing my first ever menu. And it's tough as a head chef, your first ever menu, sort of you haven't really got your own dishes. So you're sort of trying to be inspired by things you've done before and stuff and working on your style because you don't truly know what your style of cuisine is. You're sort of, like I said, you're picking from different inspirations that you might have worked in your career. So I remember my first ever menu and I showed it to Chris and he just tore it apart. And he was just like, you know, there's no balance on this menu. You're just showing off. I was like, you're completely right, because that's exactly what I was trying to do. It was like a whole career, the last 20 years, whatever it was, 15 years of my career. Let's get it all on the first menu.
I've got to prove everything on this.
Yeah. I'm going to complete it on the very first menu. And he was just like, there's no balance of flavors, no balance of fruit on there, vegetables on there, blah, 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 textures, ingredients. And it was just like, you're 100% right, chef, obviously, because he was where he was. He was always right. But it was...
You know, but you're going to be nervous,
yeah, of course you are.
You're going to have to just sort of splurge it all out and just go, right, okay, everything I've done is going to go on one menu. And
exactly.
This is
so it was like almost taking a step back and finding the style. And there was the Place Bedegroy style, don't get me wrong. I wasn't reinventing what they were or what they believed in. It was complementing what Chris's style had always been and sort of working together closely and sort of keeping the style up because there was real great loyal customer base down there. You know, like I said, you're down the middle of nowhere in down the Clyn Peninsula. So there was people that used to travel down there. A lot of people from London would go there because it was the back of beyond and they would just forget about their worries and their strife from down south. And then you know, you'd get that wonderful bread and butter of the local people that would come all the time. So suddenly they couldn't come to Place Bedegroy and go, well, why is that liquid nitrogen poached something? Oh, because the chef might have worked for Pest and Blumenthal. But you're not at the Fat Duck. You're here. So you have to be complementary to where you're working as well and not just completely change what the locals believed in as well. So it was almost working out who I was and you know, the direction that I wanted to go with Chris and sort of the future, essentially. So that's where I was when we had the phone call. For GBM, and it was crazy because if you break down England's five regions, but Wales is one. You know, you get asked to represent your whole country. It's like the Chef Olympics, isn't it?
Yeah, it's huge.
You go in there, and so I went there and I was up against two Michelin starred chefs, and you know, being the head chef of Place Bedegroy, it wasn't my star; it was Chris's Michelin star. So I wasn't a Michelin starred chef. Yes, I was the head chef of a Michelin star. The other two competitors had their own Michelin stars.
So did you feel more pressure sort of competing against them and putting your food up against all these judges?
Yeah, definitely.
Because they were not backers of coming forwards with their opinions, are they?
Far from it. And they were well respected within the industry themselves, older than me, more experienced than me. So I was going there and you're almost putting your heart in your sleeve and showing what you can hopefully do. And yes, cooking for these judges, and Angela Hartnett was the the guest judge there as well. And it was just an amazing experience, but I found it quite negative as well. So obviously, you're getting pushed to be a little bit negative and bitchy to each other, which my glass is always half full. I love promoting people. I love putting my arm around people and telling people the good things rather than
all the bad things. Do you think there's one bit of that dramatics for the cameras?
Of course, that's exactly what it is, and I totally get it, because that's sort of almost that tension feel where you've got, and you might say 10 positive things about a chef's dish, but you might say one criticism, and that's the only one that's going to get aired. And that's telly. I get that, and sort of I learned that from that, so I sort of almost didn't enjoy the almost negative side to it.
You can kind of tell. I can certainly tell when on those types of programs they're being steered into being slightly negative because that'd be nice. That'd be better for the cameras.
Absolutely, right? And I get it, because I've watched enough television to understand, and that's the way. And it's almost not falling for the words that are getting fed to you as well. Somebody to the side of the camera might choose to ask you a question and almost try and put some words in there, and you, when you're young and naive, you just want to please, don't you? And you might just say, yes, I believe that, and then you say it and go, actually, it's not something I would normally say. So it was amazing, and to get your name out there, because I believe when I did it back in the day, there was an audience of like 12 million or something, which is mega. Obviously, it's huge compared to, I think the numbers aren't quite there in modern day. I think obviously a lot of people watching.
Look at the cooking shows.
It's just
we've got
amazing.
I mean, it's saturated. There's everything at every time of the day.
Yeah.
But Great British Menu, it was like 6 o'clock, I think, on
BBC
Two. It was prime time.
There's
nothing. It wasn't compete with anything around that time. I remember we were seeing new chefs from new regions. New farms, new dairy farms. It was an incredible show.
Yeah. No, 100%. And it really was, a program that any chef, and look at the chefs that have actually been on it. When I was lucky enough to win the Welsh Heat, so then I went through to represent my country, and I was up against Nathan Outlaw and Tom Kerridge. Phenomenal, absolute heroes of mine. Lisa Allen, like I said, I met Alan Murchison, again, Michelin starred, Will Holland, Michelin starred, Kenny Atkinson, Michelin starred. So all these guys that were in the kitchen, Nathan and Tom both had 2 Michelin stars. And they were just absolute gods to me. So they were probably looking at me going, who's this kid? And I sort of, boys on tour, you might film in the day and have a few beers at night. So I didn't want to get too carried away, because my focus was truly on trying to achieve and try and put my name on a pedestal, if you like. And then so I sort of wasn't overly, in with the crowd on the first couple of days. And they were just still looking at me. I remember when it came to the fish in the main course, I got both those dishes in the top 3 of the series. And on the fish course, I came second to Kenny Atkinson. His dish was phenomenal. Came second to Tom Kerridge on the main course. But on the fish course day, Nathan Outlaw came out to me and said, Alad, your fish was my favourite of the week. And I mean, Nathan Outlaw, if anybody doesn't know him, is the number one fish cook in the UK.
Yeah.
The guy is just God when it comes to seafood. So for Nathan to actually say to me, that meant way more than some of the other.
And also, he didn't have to go and say that. That's the best compliment ever, isn't it?
100%. Yeah. And that's the sort of guy he is. He's very, very sort of wonderful, down-to-earth, amazing chef.
He always comes across like that, I must admit, as does Tom Kerridge.
Yeah, again, that Tom Kerridge, I remember that sort of that laugh he has was super contagious. You might be in a different room and then you just hear Tom with that laugh he's got from a different room, and it just makes you smile. So, yes, you were under massive pressure because everybody was there to essentially represent their region or country or whatever it was, and everybody wants to be at the banquet. But there was a lot more support together in the finals week. I think everybody sort of came together to work well, and if anybody needed that little bit of a push, then people would be there for each other
and support.
It wasn't that almost that dog eat dog. It was that almost the industry that we actually truly work in.
Yeah. Is it a supportive industry, do you think?
Oh, even more so. After lockdown and all the last couple of years we've all had, I truly believe we're closer than ever.
Yeah.
Yes, obviously you can't speak for everybody. There'll be some people that want to be me, myself and I. But yes, there's so many people that want to support, people that look after each other. But
it does seem like a close-knit industry,
yeah,
for how widespread it is, because of the amount of people I know. Oh, yeah, I know that person knows that person. Oh, yeah, I've worked there. Yeah. And because at work, we've already, established and discussed, you move around and you go, right, I'll do 18 months here and then, yeah, I'm going to go and move to this. And, I suppose it's a bit like acting. After, yeah, certain times, you go, oh, yeah, well, I work with so-and-so on that job and work with that job. We had that relationship there. Yeah,
exactly that. And if you're working, you might work, like I said, at some place. There might be 12 chefs there. They all go their own separate paths and you might go and meet up with them again. And you've always building up all these different connections throughout your entire career. You'd be stupid not to use them again. Mm. And, you can never know everything. So it doesn't take much to drop to a friend chef and say, right, chef, I've seen you do this on Instagram or whatever, Yeah, you don't need the full recipe. It might be one method or something. What was that method? What are you doing there? And, it'd be bonkers to not use those connections. So, yeah, I truly believe that the industry is really, really tight and wonderful. And, you can't feel afraid to ask questions to your peers and people you admire to. Obviously, copying and emulating is frowned upon, but being inspired by methods, there's nothing wrong with that.
No, of course not. When you came out of the Great British Menu that first time, you obviously left with a bit of a spring in your step.
Yeah.
Did you go back to being head chef or was... Yeah. Yes, you did.
Yeah, so I was head chef there and business boomed. It was massive. A lot of people were travelling then to... We put the menu on the menu, and rightly so. And people, yeah, would come in just to see, we got 9 out of 10 for this. We used that and went with it and people were travelling up to see. So you were... getting your name in, like we said, primetime television, and that's never going to be bad for your career.
Fantastic advertising.
Yeah, it really was. And to the business on sort of slower, quieter weeks was just full because of what Great British Menu, the effect that when people watched it. So, yeah, it went back to Place Bodegrois as head chef there, and it was... It was massive for us, really was.
And what was the next step after that? Did you want to have your own place?
Yeah, so I went back to Anglesey. Met a farmer couple back in Anglesey, and they were looking to open. It was almost a delicatessen, sort of a daytime brasserie feel, and then a restaurant as well as a butchery. So it was sort of almost everywhere. It was
God, there's a lot going on
many
there.
Many ticks,
Alice.
Were ticked. Well, many boxes were ticked.
Yeah.
Brian and Fiona were local farmers on Anglesey, and they were producing the best Welsh black beef. It was just phenomenal. So I sort of met these and came up with the vision of in Beaumaris and Anglesey. So by day we had Moo Bar Oink, which was the sort of the butchery side of it. And everything was coming from the farm. Literally the cows, the lamb and the pig were from the farm. So if you wanted to know any traceability, absolutely, the knowledge is yours.
I can tell you the name.
Tell you everything. And then we had a delicatessen which really promoted local Welsh produce. So everything I believed in. So loads of different Welsh suppliers, local people were in the deli, so people could come and grab whatever they wanted from there. Daytime, we had a more relaxed sort of what we called Café Moo Bar Oink. So it was cooking wonderful, a whole Welsh place from the Menai Strait. So it's come straight out of the water, and I mean literally stone's throw from the restaurant. Simply grilled, wonderful caper butter. So real classic cooking there.
But simple, but...
Yeah, real family-friendly, yeah, fish and chips. If you want a great steak from the farm, triple cooked chips, that wonderful food you want to eat.
Yeah.
And then at night time we had the restaurant upstairs, which was called Kenin, which is leeks in Welsh, by Aled Williams. So we had that restaurant upstairs. So it ticked a lot of boxes because if you came to either the restaurant or the cafe, I really like that steak. Well, we sell it. I really like that whatever. It's in the shop. So a lot of people would go there, enjoy their experience on the way out. They pick up something on the way out as well. And so you're really helping and promoting local suppliers and people with surrounding areas, as well as being able to put my own sort of stamp. So it wasn't my restaurant. It was named after me, but the farmers owned it. So I worked closely with them for just over 4 years.
Right.
Before I took the opportunity to go back into to Northcote, into Michelin. So that was the sort of the jump of going back to Northcote to lead a really well-respected brigade over there. They just had a huge investment into the hotel where they'd redone the kitchen. And for me, the kitchen is one of the best kitchens in the UK. It's just outrageous. Size of it, the equipment there, everything about it. And to, again, to be in and around the well-respected, to work with Nigel Howarth, to work with Lisa Allen, all that sort of thing. So it was a big decision to almost go over the border again and to move my family once again.
Again, of course, you're moving the family because obviously children are involved kids now.
So they were teeny tiny then. So, so they were, I think, 1 and 3, my two girls, when we moved. So
they're much more mobile at that age.
Absolutely. That's what I mean, because you haven't really got any problems. They hadn't started school or anything like that. So it was moving the family for the best reasons. And Helen, obviously, coming over to Lancashire.
Great county, Lancashire.
Not biased whatsoever.
No, not at all. Now, there's got to come a time where you've got to take the foot off the gas, because up to now, it's been very sportsmanlike, not only in the ambition, but the choices and the opportunities that you've had. And where we are now, where we're talking to you now, where you're here, this is your new job. I want to say new job, but it's not that new, really, is it?
I've been here 5.5 years.
So 5.5 years ago, everything kind of changed. Yeah. Can we just explain? It's quite very hard for me to say what it is.
So we're here at True Foods. Yeah. True Foods is in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
True Foods is world famous for fresh stock. So we make fresh stock for most of the industry peers. So pretty much if you could name a Michelin-starred chef or a good chef, potential customers of ours.
Because the one thing, when I first met you and Mitch last year, I was quite shocked to find out that most people don't make their own stock.
It's one of those things, one of those ingredients that because I was a customer before I joined here, so I can talk about it from either side of it, where I think a lot of people are saying they want to do less hours, they want to do this, want to do that. So it's, you almost look at what you're making. But for me, it's actually a more consistent product. So as a chef, you might buy a whole animal in. So you'll get a whole lamb in, let's say. So you might butcher the forequarter, the front of the animal, the start of the week, you make a stock out of that. You might butcher the hindquarter, make the back of the week, make a stock out of that. Or as a chef, you might phone up your butcher and say, I need 50 kilo bones. You don't spec anything. It's just 50 kilo of said bone from that animal.
If you were making a stock from, say, the front of the lamb, and then you were making it from the back of the lamb, is that because it's two very different flavours?
Yeah, so every bone has a different gelatinous quality or cellular structure. So, and like fat content, if you look at like cows, for instance, you've got bone marrow full of bones. The fat is an enemy of stock, essentially. That's where you get bone broths and stuff like that, where you want the fat into it. So actually, to break it down scientifically, what we do here at True Foods is make a way more consistent stock for the industry. So it doesn't matter if you buy a bag of our stock on a Monday in January to a Wednesday in March, we're hopefully giving you the most consistent stock possible, because what we do is we break it down to the actual, we only use one bone from the animal, and we always spec it. So it's the same spec of bone, the same recipe of mirepoix vegetables, the same, so what we're doing is just doing it on a grander scale. So the same kettles, the same temperature, the same people. A lot of people that work here at True Foods are, 10 plus years. There's many people that work for Mitch and Jack for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is giving the kitchens a more consistent stock than they can actually make themselves. And you think a lot of people will be making a stock overnight. Again, you put it on before you go and you come back and it's there when you come in for breakfast and stuff, Crazy, because obviously you don't need to go into the dangers of that, and it's invalidating your insurance and all that sort of jazz. But that's a sort of an average thing, because you can't really have a stock kettle on during the day, because it might take over, your solid top, or you take three of your burners off from your six burner or something, and then you've got the end of the night. If it's been going all day, then after doing a grueling 17-hour days, you've got to pass it. Then obviously getting rid of the waste. But what we're doing here now is
I made a 2-day stock over Christmas salad. Yeah, I feel the pain. I won't be doing that again anytime soon. But the gravy was very good, I must admit. It was worth
it. Absolutely. No, it really is. And truly, you can, where you think of it, from the moment you walk into a restaurant to just before your dessert, stock could go in anywhere. You know, any single one of those courses, you could have stock in it. So it's a massive fundamental ingredient in any kitchen. So when we're making stocks for 3-star Michelin stock chefs, if it's not right, you know, you're going to know about it. And that's, again, that's the pressure that we'll put on ourselves here, because, you know, we make it the same way as any industry would make it. And that's why chefs truly love True Foods, is because we don't do anything different, where, you know, we don't add any additives or salt or anything like that. It's just made on a bigger scale.
And it's as good as what they would make and what they need
absolutely.
For their products.
And better most of the time. Yeah. You know, I've part of my position, I go and present into these massive kitchens, 3-star Michelin, and they sort of look at you and go, why would I want to buy your stock? And then they try it and go, I understand that. And, you know, there was a 3-star Michelin kitchen that we went to, and they ended up redesigning their kitchen, and they took out all stock-making facilities. They gained an extra section. You're almost gaining extra member staff, because you haven't got that member of staff that's caring for the stock throughout the day. So they reap the benefits straight away. And it was you know, really good for them to take that stress almost out, and for them, they get a more consistent product.
And so by you moving here 5 and a bit years ago, I take it Helen and the children are much happier, because you're not doing the grueling hours, are you?
No.
As you were.
Far from it. It was one of them. It was a massive decision. So I met Mitch Mitchell. Mitch is the owner, the founder of True Foods. So I met Mitch because he came over to Northcote. Sort of having a conversation with him, and he was saying he was looking for someone to join True Foods to help take the company forward, to be head of innovation. So it was one of those that I didn't really think anything of it, and it must have been one of those long, grueling out days. And I remember going home at 1 o'clock in the morning, and Helen used to just grunt at me and sort of ask how my day was, but didn't really care, because it was 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And I was just like, do you fancy Yorkshire? And she was just like, shut up. Talk about it tomorrow. So we did, and sort of asked him the question to Mitch, like, well, tell me more about the position. Because everybody knows about the stock side of it, but there's way more to True Foods than just making stock. We make so many other different things. So it was that conversation with Mitch, and actually, you know, meeting like-minded people was phenomenal, because the man's just an inspiration to all of us.
Yeah.
You can tell by the amount of long stayers here. And it's family-run, you know, so you've got Mitch, Jack, his wife, and then Simon, the son. The three of them are all here. It's a wonderful family-run company that, you know, you're just not... It's not all about just figures, it's about quality. So actually meeting Mitch was a massive light bulb moment for me. And then he basically said, you know, it's a Monday to Friday position, and it was 8 till 5.
I mean, that's like a normal job, Alan. What's going on?
It's just bonkers. And that, I sort of almost, I struggled with it to start off with. When I first joined True Foods, I mentally struggled with doing less hours.
Because you've been doing it for so many years. You're
drilled to do, you know, and it is almost addictive. You get used to doing 17, whatever hours you do in a day. So when I was finishing at 5 o'clock, I'd end up going into the office and go, what do you need? What do you want? And I remember Jack was saying to me, she's like, just go home, chef. And I was just like, no, this was 5 o'clock. What do you need? And she's like, go home. I was like, oh. So like, it took a little bit of time to actually truly be at one, be comfortable with having a personal life, which sounds mental, but it was just where I was.
But as you said, you know, you've been conditioned to work in all these unsociable hours for so many years.
Yeah, exactly. And then actually having a personal life and now being able to go home and have dinner with my family, you know, to actually sit down and the four of us have dinner together. It was, you know, that's unheard of for someone in kitchens. You just can't do that unless it's your day off, and you might only get one day off a week and stuff. But to be able to do that all the time is you know, it's the dream, isn't it?
So having taken a foot off the gas and you're doing lovely Monday to Friday, 8 to 5, that's not always the case now, Aled, because what is Chef's Table all about? Because you're now, what, how many courses is it? Is it 11 courses?
Well, actually, the current menu is up to about 17
in
total.
Whose idea was this? Because you're supposed to not be doing these unsociable hours anymore.
So it was the brainchild of Mitch and myself. So we actually went over to Barcelona on business, because we were...
As you do.
As you do. So it's a wonderful, again, perk to have. We were over in Barcelona, and you go to the La Boqueria, like everybody should. So we were having a beer there, and we were talking about, you know, ideas of what we could have. And Mitch learned that Claude Bozzi from Bibendum was moving from Hibiscus to go over to Bibendum. And he's like, oh, I wonder what he's doing with his Electrolux room, his little private dining room. So very surreal, early doors into my job. Mitch was on the phone walking down La Boqueria to Claude Bozzi, as you do, and striking a deal, asking what he was going to do with his private dining room. And the deal was done, and Mitch and I were down in London the following week, bringing up what we know now as the chef table, the actual table itself, the extractor fan, an oven, a blast chiller, a backpack machine from one of the most prestigious London restaurants there ever was, up to its new home in Yorkshire. So we had a wonderful presentation table. And then the idea was genuinely to have somewhere to present to when we get these megastar chefs come in to...
Because it is like, it's just like a very... I mean, it's the highest end test kitchen I've ever seen.
It's amazing. It's a wonderful place to be in, because it's very inspirational. The room is sort of, Mitch calls it the heartbeat of the company, because most things start in that room. You know, we've got freeze dryers, you know, vacuum chambers, all sorts of crazy bits of kit that chefs could only dream about working with. And we came up with the idea of having the table to present to, you know, multi-Michelin star chefs that come for tasting sessions or you know, people from different companies. But we thought, one weekend, Mitch and I thought, oh, okay, why don't we do a dinner for loved ones? And we had wives and partners that came for dinner.
Yeah.
We did a little taster menu for them. I can't remember, it was like 5 or 6 courses to start off with. And we buzzed off it. It was amazing. It was just, you know, dipping your toes back into the industry again. And then we did another one for ladies of the office. You know, so we had a table of 5 again the following month or something, which was amazing. And then we invited some local people from Yorkshire Magazine as well, Yorkshire Life Magazine. And they were just like, guys, you need to open. This is so different. This is, you need to actually sell this to the public. And we were like, yeah, okay. It's one of those, like I would say, it's one of those battles of, you know, you're trying to step away from the grueling craziness.
Yeah.
But it is on our terms, where what Mitch gives us is the freedom to innovate, which
is also control.
It's just like nothing that I've ever worked in before, where a lot of kitchens are restricted by so many financial restrictions, staffing restrictions, stuff. Mitch just gives us complete freedom to just cook amazing food. So we opened up to paying public to, you know, 3 years ago, I think it was now, where people were booking in. And we had Elaine Lem from Yorkshire Post Magazine, who's a well-regarded journalist from the area, and she came in and she gave us 5 out of 5 for every criteria. So that put us straight away a bit more of a pedestal, a bit more pressure to live up to, but as you well know, we all like pressure.
Well, you certainly do, more than most, Alan,
yeah,
to be honest.
So it was a wonderful sort of thing to live up to that. So then we were doing 6 covers at that point, and then we went to 8 covers, and then we went to 10 covers. So we're at 10, we've stayed at 10 because what we feel is that it's a small enough number to do what we do brilliantly. If you start going to 10 or 20, it's not quite what we do at the chef's table. So, you know, for that, it was a perfect amount of perfect number. And then, you know, we were doing it for a couple of years, and then we had the Giles Corran review, which was a massive game changer for us. So Giles, obviously, writer for the Times, well-regarded, and I believe he's only given 3 10 out of 10s in his 25-year career, and we were one of them.
Yeah.
So for that, it massively sort of...
Well, it just blew up after that, didn't it?
Huge. And it was phenomenal. I get goose pimples every time I say that, because it's just bonkers. I love the fact, you know, we got there and what we've done as a team is amazing, because we've got a wonderful team here that have all come to build the direction we want it to go in. And we've got different styles of chefs. There's 4 or 5 different chefs in total, but only 2 or 3 of us will cook on the night. So you've got lots of different style of people to come in and do a chef table menu. But to get that from Giles, suddenly, you know, it was going from the bread and butter might have been Yorkshire people, from Leeds to Newcastle might have been coming for dinner, but now we've got, you know, people driving up from London or a lot of people coming from, you know, Manchester way or something. And we had a table recently that came over. I was like, oh, where are you from? They're like, oh, California. But we were coming over to see mum and dad, but we just made sure that we booked the table before we flew over.
Wow.
And I was just like, that's ridiculous. You know, you've got really amazing restaurants in California,
and you're coming to an industrial estate in Yorkshire.
Which I love. It's like everything, you know, you come into an industrial estate, and as soon as you walk into the test kitchen, then, you know, it's everything's... you know, polished and shiny and amazing, but you're still in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And it's, for me, I think it's like nothing else in the UK where there's a lot of chef tables.
But this is different because it's a long night.
Yeah.
But it's an intimate evening.
Yeah.
And there's great conversations to be had all the way through each course.
Yeah, and what I love is you can truly get the answer straight away where you might go to a normal restaurant and say, oh, tell me about the beef, and, you know, the service staff will go and ask the chef if they don't quite know. And, you know, it's almost that robotic answer that the chef might have given to them, so you can't really get more in-depth answer. But for us, the people can ask absolutely anything they want, whenever they want. And, you know, it's a better evening when they do. Like, nobody wants to sit there in silence, do you?
And it's, so being prepped centimetres from your face.
Everything's cooked fresh in front of them, so everything is literally cooked in front of you. So you've almost got that cook school sort of learning aspect to it. And the amount of questions we get might not even be about the food we're cooking either. It might just be completely random. So tell me your roast potatoes. How'd you do the best roast potatoes? So it's got nothing to do with what you're cooking, but because they're in that sort of almost five-hour experience that we have, they can almost feel like they can ask you whatever you want. So, yeah, Chef Table is giving us everything that we might have missed from the craziness of the wonderful career that I've gone through. So Chef Table gives, you know, me personally, everything that I might miss, everything I want. And what Mitch has very amazingly done is given us the platform to cook creatively and have fun, which is what we really promote as a team. It's not about an atmosphere, it's not about being negative or anything like that. It's about promoting each other, looking at, you know, different skill setters and different experiences from all the team, and come up with a creative menu and you know, giving our guests the best experience we possibly can.
And also, if you're lucky, you may get asked to help with the prep of the dessert, like I did, and it put me under a lot of pressure. But hopefully I came through for you, Alan.
Oh, absolutely.
Alan Williams, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Absolute joy. Thank you, man.
Thank you.
And another episode is done. Oh, the determination of Chef Alan there. Brilliant chat. Thank you so much for inviting us over to Yorkshire and having a sit down with a cup of tea and talking about food and chefs' determination. So that's it for the trilogy of chefs for now. For now, I say, because there are some food-related guests coming up in the future. I can't say yet. And another thing that I can't say, it's so annoying, isn't it? But are you excited about festivals this year? You plan on going to any? Well, look, all I can say for now is keep an eye on the lineups. Your favourite podcast, that's us, may be around. If you can't say anything, I'm sworn to secrecy. Anyway, they'll kill me. But if you at podcasts and you fancy, if you're at podcasts, if you're at festivals and you fancy sitting down and coming to see us, then I will let you know when I am allowed. I promise. It's a goodie. Episode 11, season 9 next week, shall we? I'm going to record it this afternoon. Do you want to know who it is? Are you a fan of Doctor Who? You like Broadchurch? I'm going to sit down with the brilliant Arthur Darvill. It's been a long time coming. We've been talking about this for about a year. So we're finally going to do it. I'm really excited. He's a good, good guy. I managed to work with him last year, but we didn't spend half enough time as we would have liked, just because of scheduling. But I'm looking forward to sitting down this afternoon with him. So that's next week, season 9, episode 11, with the wonderful actor, musician, singer, composer, theatre maker, Arthur Darvill. Yeah. Okay. Well, until next week, thank you so much for downloading and subscribing and supporting us. If you would like to support us and you have found
a few pound coins when you've been cleaning the sofa, and you think, do you know what? We get these podcasts free every week, rich, interesting guests, lovely conversations, me waffling on, you don't have to pay for that. And you would like to support us, you know, whatever you can do is always great. You go to patreon.com/twoshotpod. Over there, you get lots of extras, lots of videos, lots of new photos. We're doing weekly lens videos when we can, when we're out and about on the road, teasing who the guests are. You'll find out first who the guests are. And also, we'll be telling you what festivals will be at when we can. Breaking news over on Patreon. Go and have a look, see if you fancy supporting. And you can drop out when you want. If you can't afford 1 month, come back on. People change their tiers all the time, but all help is grateful. So thank you. But if you can't, that's okay. Maybe you can in a few months. But until then, thank you again for downloading, subscribing, telling your friends, saying hello on social media. It's always welcome. Until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been Producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.